Hey, everybody!
Hello again. I don't know why I'm doing that voice, but hi.
We are here to do episode 20, the final episode.
Season finale.
Of our first season.
It's going to end in a cliffhanger.
Somehow, yes. Our show where we recommend that you watch and read things.
Right.
It's going to end with a cliffhanger.
That'll never be resolved because we'll get canceled. And then all of television will be like wondering, oh my god, what happened? Wait, this isn't even television. I don't know what I'm talking about. Don't mind me.
You are, of course, listening to our show, which has a name. And that name wasn't designed to be a joke.
No.
But it plays as a joke every time I tell someone the name of this podcast, and I think I've made this joke before. But, like, it's just true. The name of our show is Does It Matter?
I didn't really think about that, actually, but that is kind of funny.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Yeah, I have a podcast. Oh, really? What is it called? Does It Matter?
Well, yeah, I need to look it up. That reminds me of a joke in a movie that is going to be my weekly recommendation, so I will get to that.
Spectacularly.
But for now, let's talk about tone.
So I guess we thought it would be fun on some level to go with, like, the vaguest.
Yeah.
Like, the most easily interpreted of all of our themes yet.
What is tone?
What is tone? Well, interestingly, tone was not our first word for it. I had elected the concept of atmosphere, which is a much more specific concept.
Kind of, yeah.
And you countered with, how about tone? And here we are.
I may have regretted that.
Why? But,
struggling for a definition. Although I feel like I'm in a good place with what I came up with, so.
Well, I distinctly recall that I started us off last time.
Okay.
So, why don't you then lead us into a talk about tone?
Let's crack some knuckles here. So, the first thing that I often do, because I'm somewhat pedantic, when I'm confronted with, like, alright, what do I even mean by this, is I look up the word. And in this case, I sort of came about the idea that tone has different meanings in different art forms, potentially. Like, a musical tone is essentially, like, a specific wavelength. It's related to pitch, but it's not exactly the same as pitch. And it's kind of like a base element of music on which things like pitch and timbre and attack and etc., etc. can be developed. Visual art has, like, a different kind of definition for tone related to sort of, like, shading and contrast, where, like, you know, you have your darker tones and your lighter tones, and the juxtaposition and arrangement of them creates depth and realism and that sort of thing. And then literature, tone is basically, like, what is an author's attitude toward the subject they are discussing? And you sort of have to, like, focus on the individual associations of, like, the language that they are using to describe the situation, what details are being focused on, that kind of thing, and, like, pulling it out. So, in approaching this, I was like, well, okay, I think mostly we're probably kind of referring to that last one, because that we tend to focus on storytelling media, generally speaking, I think.
True.
And also, like, it's hard to talk about visual art on a podcast, because it's a podcast, so there's that. But, I guess I'm sort of using those definitions as a structure for approaching this. So my first one is a musical thing.
Okay.
And specifically, it is an album that came out in 1978, and is considered kind of a watershed moment in, electronic music, certainly, but also, like, film scoring and a lot of other kinds of music outside of the, you know, pop genre. It even sort of defined a name for the genre to which it belongs, even though it is not necessarily the first entry in that genre. And that is Ambient One, Music for Airports by Brian Eno. So this is an album that basically consists of four compositions, ranging between 6 and 16 minutes in length, that are essentially repeating tape loops of, like, simple melodic structures that kind of float in and out of sequence and synchronicity with each other. It's kind of building on work that was done by a number of other composers in, like, the modern period of classical music and leading up through the first half of the 20th century. In particular, I think Erik Satie kind of jumps out a lot. I'm pretty sure he's the one that had the furniture music, I think is what it was. It's in French, so, you know, I don't know. But, like, music that was designed to be, like, very kind of gentle and simplistic and absorbable. Well, simplistic is maybe not the right word. Simplistic in a facet, anyway. With some depth in how those simple forms are juxtaposed with one another. And so, Eno kind of draws on that a little bit, and, like, he had already done work kind of that poked at this a little bit. Like, he was always a bit of an experimentalist, which is part of what made Roxy Music so interesting for the period that he was in it, because you had, like, Brian Ferry being, like, the stylish crooner, and then Eno being like, no, fuck that, let's be weird. And, like, for three or so albums, that worked really well. And then they decided that they did not want to do that. Anyway, after that, Brian Eno made, like, Discreet Music in 1975, and a couple of other, like, more pop-oriented solo albums before getting around to this one. And supposedly, the inspiration for this was kind of a couple places, I guess, it came from. One was just, like, being frustrated with the idea of Muzak, that it's like, okay, this is a stripping down of, like, popular music that has made music designed to be absorbed in environments kind of ridiculous and, like, not worthy of consideration, and that's not necessarily fair. Like, this is a specific use for music and a place for music to exist, and there can be a kind of music that is designed for this that has thought and art put into it. Why are we not doing that? And specifically, Music for Airports was, I guess, he was, like, stuck in an airport in Germany for a while and, like, was listening to the terrible music and was like, you know what, I can do better than this, fuck you guys. So that's where this album came from. He wrote most of it, except for the first one, which is, the track titles are, like, 1/1, 1/2, 2/1, etc. Well, 2/2, there's only four. And I think he solo wrote three of those, and then 1/1 was co-written with, I want to say, Robert Wyatt of Soft Machine. I forget exactly, but that sounds right in my head. I did not write it down. He was explicit about his intentions in the liner notes for the record, where he's like, okay, he explains the dissatisfaction with music, etc., etc., and then says that, like, his goal with this was to make music as ignorable as it is interesting. So, like, that right there gives you kind of an authorial attitude toward the subject, where it's like, this is music that is meant to be evocative of a particular experience, but in, like, a really sort of roundabout, weird way. The actual sounds that are on the record are mostly, like, kind of 70s early synth tones and pianos. There's a couple, like, lightly distorted vocals, wordless, just, you know, choral sort of vocals. It fits in with a lot of, like, other early electronica music from the 70s. I have, like, Autobahn, Jean-Michel Jarre's Oxygen, which is in my car right now, and God, I love that album. Tangerine Dream's Phaedra, like, I was about to say tonally, but I was like, wait, hold on. But, like, in terms of, like, the characteristics of the sounds are similar to that, but it's a little less frenetic than any of those are. Like, even Phaedra is kind of has a little bit more motion than this one does. And this one is, like, very, like, slow little arpeggios on a piano with, like, oh, droning kind of sounds underneath that for a second, and then it goes away, and then a different sort of drone underneath it,
all while this motif is repeating, you know, that sort of thing. The result has this, what I would characterize now, I mean, I wasn't alive in 1978, so I don't know quite how to contextualize it in terms of that, but what I would characterize now as sort of this retro-futuristic quality. And what I find most interesting about it is that it is really strangely evocative of airports. Like, there's... I'm gonna get, like, into some really abstract shit here, because, like, it's very hard to describe music in terms of, like, synesthetic quality.
I always appreciate your attempts to, though.
Like, it's very neat, fluorescent, specifically. Like, it has the characteristic of fluorescent light. It's very, like, whites and light blues and greens. There's a lot of open space in it, a lot of, like, very gentle lines and sort of modern curves and things like that. And sort of a counterpoint for that is, or not counterpoint, analog, I guess, there's a joke in there. An analog for that is the architecture of airports in particular. Like, they are generally tend to be very big open spaces. The white is usually a very predominant color. There's, like, a lot of kind of flowy lines and big domes and columns that get wider as they get toward the bottom, and, like, swooshy shapes and things like that. And this is sort of a musical equivalent of that. And I was thinking about that, and I think probably part of that has to do with the fact that air travel is kind of stressful. And I think the...
Only kind of?
Well... Depends on your perspective, I suppose. Except for, like, actually being cramped into the airplane, I don't mind it. But I also don't do it very often, so that probably has, you know, something to do with that.
Right.
But, like, this stressful experience is... The space that you are in is designed to mitigate that in what feels like a conscious way. Like, it's supposed to be like, okay, this is a very serene environment. You can be calm here. It doesn't really work, because, like, it's full of people running around. But being in a space like that, you feel like, okay, that's what this is for. And, like, musically, this album kind of does that same thing. Like, this is supposed to be, like, gentle and absorbable and, like, I can breathe. This is a simple pattern that my brain can latch onto. Like, there's depth to it if I want to pay attention to it, but I don't have to. It's fine. Which is precisely the point. Music that is as ignorable as it is interesting. And what's interesting to me is, like, how well those two kind of different art forms, architecture and music, overlap in this space. Like, they both tap into this experiential quality in some kind of really ineffable way, I think. And, like, that... When talking about those sort ineffable sort of things, like, it's kind of a counter-cultural colloquialism, say that five times fast, to say, like, yeah, I feel that vibe. Like, it's a vibration, it's a worm, it's a particular frequency, and that is a tone.
I dig it. Right. Airport music.
Yeah. It's a good album. I would recommend it. Like, it's great to, like, just kind of... I need to wash this day off.
Music for airports, I should say.
Mm.
So I started with a very different tone. I went with a video game for my first option, and this video game, you know, I did my writing and my research for this particular entry, and then I started thinking about, like, how much weirder it is than I conceptualized it as before, like, when I thought about all its weirdness at the same time.
I love that. It's like, this seemed normal until I thought about it. Fuck.
I mean, like, it seemed like a step off of normal. And then I really took it all in and I went, oh no, like this is a different animal than I thought I was looking at. This is crazy. Let me stop building it up. It's called Dear Esther.
Okay.
So almost no one has heard of this game. You don't need to worry about the fact that you haven't.
The title tinkles like a tiny little bell in the back of my head, but that's all I got.
Okay, let me just give you like a little taste of like how weird this is gonna get.
Okay.
This is, as far as I know, the only video game that was ever created as an intellectual experiment at a university to see whether or not you could turn the poetry of William S. Burroughs into a video game using none of his words.
So you know how, like, in cartoons where someone says something and then you see, like, the character's pupils explode like tiny little mushroom clouds?
Yeah.
That just happened.
Yeah, that's what we're dealing with here. That's why you haven't heard of this game. It's because it's, like, really fucking weird.
I really, really want to play it now,
okay.
though.
So here's the thing, and you can easily. I love it. Dear Esther came out in 2012. By this production company called The Chinese Room. Originally, it was released in 2008 as a mod for the Source Engine, which is a component of like the Steam operating system, essentially.
Okay.
Let me actually take a moment to explain this properly. The way that the Source Engine works is essentially. An atmosphere that you can put all of your game's variables into and it runs on it, so that you don't have to program like an entire system for physics manipulation or like
that makes sense.
Moving or manipulating the Earth, like it's just all built in, and then you can make a game.
It gets you most of the way there.
Right. now, as it is. Now, Dear Esther is available not only on PC and Mac, but also on PS4 and Xbox One.
Sweet, because I have one of those.
Yeah, when I got it on computer, like 8 years ago, I got it for less than I think $5. So like, if it's much more than $5 on PS4 network, like, that's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
But still get it, because it's worth the fucking play. So the game itself is mostly exploration-based. You arrive at the beginning of the game on this dock, and you move from the dock onto this island. The island, I found out while doing some research, is in... Oh man, I looked up how to pronounce it and I forgot it. The Hebrides?
Hebrides?
Hebrides, that's I right. So you're on a Hebridean island. And you just start exploring. And as you make your way, this narrator, like essentially you'll hit a certain point of like distance covered, and the narrator, this sort of like solemn-voiced man, will read letters to dear Esther.
Okay.
As you get more and more of the letters, you start to figure out what he's actually talking about and make some sense of what's going on the island to you. But it's all very mysterious. Like, there's no clear answers even at the end. So the fact that it's just like little bits and like trickles of information is exactly what the game is trying to do to you.
Okay.
You find, and I should note, the letters become increasingly emotional. Like, they start off with like some real wistful energy, but
mm-hmm.
like he's choked with like tears at some points reading these letters, which makes when he starts to read, like, a very mixed emotion kind of situation. So, like, I'm about to experience a very intense emotional experience, but I'm also, like, progressing the plot. This is very interesting.
Okay.
So you find on this island a shipwreck, some abandoned buildings, and a cave system. As you get further into the game, especially into the caves, you start finding these glowing images. Now, these images... they generally appear on walls, especially in the caves. They look like chemical diagrams and schematics. This is part of the game's beauty, its tone. Like, it just throws this stuff on the wall, and clearly it means something, but there is absolutely no indication what the fuck it means. So, like, you start trying to make some sense of, like, what could it mean if, like, a diagram looking like this and a chemical pattern looking like this have to do with a letter about, like, something has gone wrong in the relationship. Like, what does it all build to?
This does sound kind of like reading Burroughs.
Yeah. So here's a fun fact about the game. They wrote a total of 19 letters into the game. If you are to play it multiple times, you can access all of them, but each playthrough only gives you 11 letters, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, even knowing that you've completed the game, part of the story is missing.
I love like, and hate that.
I knew when I was sitting here writing about this game, I was like, Alex is gonna fucking love Dear Esther.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to download this.
The letters themselves only hint at the plot. They slowly indicate that Esther has died and that it was someone else's fault. So you begin seeing a figure in the distance on the island.
Yes.
But every time you get, like, close enough to find out, it's gone already. Of course. You hear the narrator in the letters start accusing a man of killing his wife via a drunk driving accident. Like, things start getting really, really intense. You arrive at an electrical tower and experience the incredibly poetic and bizarre end of this game. Each move the game makes...
I don't know what I'm doing
this week. This game takes less than an hour to play.
Okay.
You'll probably want to replay it to get, like, new... Because I think they actually, like, shift the island a little bit. But, like, you'll definitely want to come back for more of what the letters have to say. So each move the game makes adds to its, like, bizarre atmosphere. It's always making you feel alone and uncertain. Like, even when you know that there's something else on the island and you're trying to find it, like, it doesn't make you feel less alone. If anything, more alone.
Yeah.
Mystery is really at the key of everything that it's doing. It has cryptic letters, unexplained symbols, what happened to the island in the first place, even. Like, they're all sort of, like, hinted at, but never given to you.
Just as a quick side note, what the fuck happened on this island is, like, such a great basis for so much pop culture.
Yeah, we got Myst, we got Lost.
Lord of the Flies. Fucking...
Yeah. So I want to note specifically about the glowing symbols. They're part of the mystery, and they are solvable. I'm going to give you a little bit of information here, but I'm not gonna give you, like, the solution.
Okay.
Some of the symbols include the chemical map of what ethanol looks like, a diagram of a brake system, and images of what neurons look like under a microscope.
Okay.
A
relationship is forming.
Yes. There's stuff going on. I won't give it all to you, but Dear Esther, as I teased, was originally developed as a research project at the University of Portsmouth. It was inspired by the works of William S. Burroughs. The person who created it essentially made this game as, like, an experiment and found that there was some intrigue in the gaming community from it. Like, he didn't really think at that point that a narrative, especially, like, a confusing narrative game, would have an audience. But, like, it has definitely become and remained a cult game over time.
It's so neat being at the point in video game history where we are, where people are actually like, oh, we can do shit with this.
Yeah, so he ended up, like, processing the rights together with this the Chinese Room company to turn it into a commercially available game, which, like, apparently they made what is called a spiritual sequel to it, I have not played it. The first I found out about it was during some research, but...
What's that one called?
I don't know. If you go to the Wikipedia page, it tells you. The Wikipedia page for Dear Esther. So this game is, quote, according to the people who designed it, deliberately image-heavy, symbolic, and poetic. And I have to say, for its mournful, melancholic, mysterious tone, please try Dear Esther.
I'm gonna. That sounds awesome.
I was recommended the game when I was in undergrad, and mine, who is actually now my brother's wife, wrote like one of her first like major undergrad papers about Dear Esther. So I come from a Dear Esther fan.
Okay. So my second one is going to be the hardest to talk about because it is the one I have experienced directly the least recently. But I dig it, so I do want to talk about it.
Let's hear it.
It is a comic series that lasted from 2002 to 2015 and is apparently considered one of the last great Vertigo imprints. I am referring to Fables by Bill Willingham.
Oh, Fables.
It was also developed into a pretty damn good video game by Telltale Games in 2013-2014. And supposedly there was going to be another one, but then that whole, like, Telltale Games thing happened. So
yeah,
we'll see how that goes. Okay, so gritty reboot is a phrase that sort of sends slight shivers up my spine at this point in the culture.
Much.
Even in 2002, this was not entirely a new subject, nor was the idea of repurposing fairy tales, because let's not forget Shrek existed.
Yeah, the year before.
And it was a book before that, I found out. I did not know that.
Shrek was a book?
It was. Like, I did not know this. It kind of blew my mind. The illustrations are fucking hilarious, though.
I've seen those. I didn't realize they were from the book. It's a book.
I know.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just having, like, a universal meltdown.
It'll do that. okay. So, all of that, Fables is kind of a fairy tale gritty reboot. But it's done in a really interesting and kind of clever way. The premise is basically, like, what if fairy tale characters were real and secretly had their own community in New York City? And it kind of just runs with that. Over the course of 150 issues and 13 years, collected in 22 volumes, which I do not own and would like to correct that, but I don't have any money, it follows a couple of different major story arcs, mostly revolving around a few central characters, primarily Big B Wolf. Big B Wolf, Big Bad Wolf, you see where I'm going with this. Who has reformed his terrorizing ways, mostly, to become head of security for the Fabletown community and, you know, the sort of grizzled detective type that you see in noir-y sort of things. So, this character fits pretty well into the overall flavor of the world, because, you know, the plot, like, it starts off with basically a murder mystery in, like, a very film noir fashion.
Oh, very much so.
Other plot lines that sort of crop up are, like, various sorts of, like, political intrigue, conspiracy theories, the entire prosecution of a war in the Fables community, and, like, the impacts that all of these things have on the lives of this community that has to exist with all of its diversity and while simultaneously trying to stay under the radar of the mundanes, normal people. So, in approaching this subject, like, I tried to figure out where exactly this quote came from, other than Wikipedia, and I couldn't, but, like, Willingham kind of talked about the idea that, like, anything that was in the public domain was fair game for this story. Like, so, sorry, brain just kind of derailed for a second. That'll happen.
The cat in your lap, it's understandable.
Yeah, I feel like a supervillain. Yeah, yeah. So we get, like, components of things like Grimm's Fairy Tales, The Wizard of Oz, Arthurian Legend, The Thousand and One Arabian Nights, The Jungle Books, The Tales of Sinbad, Santa Claus, Norwegian folklore, Germanic folklore, Celtic folklore, etc., etc. It's a whole friggin' melting pot of all sorts of things. And, like, all of these characters are repurposed into interesting ways. And he pulls off a really kind of fun inversion with it. Because one sort of common thing that runs through all of these, like, sort of folkloric stories in general is that they are ways of approaching serious topics in a more lighthearted, fanciful way.
Mm-hmm.
The Wizard of Oz being, like, a fun example for that. I will never forget, like, being in 11th grade history and having, like, this is about, like, late 19th century politics and grange farming, and, like, having that whole metaphor explained to me.
Oh, yeah.
I do not remember all the ins and outs of it now. It's complex.
William Jennings Bryan loves the gold standard.
So, like, these fairy tales are, like, you know, taking very serious subjects and essentially making kind of something light out of them. And what Fables does is it turns that back around, and it takes these archetypal characters that we are used to thinking of in these light, bright, silly, fantastical terms, and makes stories about them that are about more serious, personal, intense things. A really kind of off-sighted example of that is the character of Prince Charming, who, in the Fables arc, is very much a alpha douche, I guess. A user and manipulator of women.
He reminds me of, like, a worse version of Sawyer from Lost.
Okay. Yeah. Oh my god, that fits with what I remember. It's been a fucking long time. Unfortunately, like, my old roommate had these, and that's where I read them, and I was like, this is fucking amazing. And then I moved out and never bought them. But
my reaction when I read, like, the first, I think, like, 3 issues was like, oh, I'm gonna buy all these. And then I was like, oh, there's like 20 something of them, and they're all like $20
yeah,
a pop.
And I don't have $400 right now for this.
Yeah. I have $400 for rent.
Yeah.
$100 to begin rent.
Exactly. But anyway, so, like, Prince Charming is this, you know, he's this character who's, like, very much more concerned with his own image and very manipulative and very exploitative and, like, has a really kind of fucked up gender dynamic and all of that. And across kind of the arc of the story becomes a little bit more self-aware about that and progresses in that, and, like, that's what his story is about. Bigby's story is, like, constantly wrestling with that inner nature, with that, like, you know, I could absolutely go off and just murder everyone. That is something that I past me would have done, but I'm not gonna do that. Nope. And, like, very much bringing these kind of inner conflicts to the fore and really exploring what you can do by reappropriating these characters. Bluebeard's another fun one. That's not a story as enough people know, I found out. Like, I don't know. Anyway, that's a side thing. Like, I like that story a lot. Ooh, hi, buddy. I like that story a lot. In this Fable Town, he's, like, this very wealthy, kind of shadowy, behind-the-scenes dude, and you're, like, never totally sure, like, what his motives are, or if he's, like, a good guy or a bad guy, and he's kind of both. Yeah. So, in my notes here, I have, so what exactly is the tone? It's, like, it's a mix of playfulness and serious that runs through both the writing and the art. Because, like, there is a lot of humor in this series. I don't want to make it sound like it's all action intensity all the time. Even
well, it's,
kind of is, but
it's, like, a very self-aware humor, because what they're doing is they're taking fairy tales as seriously as possible.
Mm-hmm.
They have to then, like, step back and be like, okay, and we know that it's silly.
Yeah.
So, like, you have to go hard on both to get it to work.
And it does remarkably well.
Yeah.
And so and that actually leads right into sort of the ending point that I have, where it's like, okay, so by going hard on both, you have this kind of mixture of light and dark that creates depth and realism, kind of like artistic tone. Hey, see what I did there?
I see it.
So, would recommend. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I see now why you were like, oh, that might be the one that you that we both have to say.
Yeah, prior to the show, prior to, I think, like, every show, we've had a discussion of, like, I wonder if we're going to overlap this time.
Well, because, like, we talked, like, before we'd even recorded an episode about, like, the rules if we talk about the same one, and we were so concerned about it, it's just, like, never come close to happening. All right, let's talk about number two for me. I went with a book that I read just this, I'm going to say winter, but by the time you hear this, it will probably be, like, early summer, so that doesn't mean much.
Yeah.
I read this book called But What If We're Wrong? By Chuck Klosterman.
Okay.
Came out in 2016, has a fantastic subtitle, Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. Say it's a fantastic subtitle because it actually completely defines what the entire book seeks to do.
Okay.
And that is very rare in titling.
Yeah, that is true.
As far as I am concerned. And that's what the question is. Put another way, can we be more accurate in our thinking about ourselves if we view ourselves as part of a distant past? Some of Klosterman's writing is concerned with what we all believe now that could be totally wrong. His chief example for that is gravity. He sits and he talks to, like, huge, super famous astrophysicists, scientists. Like, he talks to Neil deGrasse Tyson at one point. He talks to a guy who's, like, the opposite of Neil deGrasse Tyson in the world of astrophysics, but who's, like, as famous within that world.
Do you remember that guy's name?
Brian Green, I want to say.
Okay.
Green with an E on the end. And he's super charming and not at all a dick like Neil deGrasse Tyson is.
Kinda, yeah.
Maybe he is, but he doesn't, like, ostensibly come off as one. And essentially this guy, I want to say his name is Brian Green, he says, you know, we could be totally wrong about gravity. Like, our understanding of gravity 500 years ago was completely different than it is now. We were still pretty much thinking what Aristotle told us, which was things want to be on the ground because that's what they want.
Hey.
Which is actually what he has written down in books. Yeah, Green's like, what if... you know, we come in and, like, we just recently had gravity revolutionized by Einstein. Like, 500 years from now, like, by all means, it could be, like, that we are totally wrong about gravity.
Quick side point. Do you know if they actually discovered the graviton or if that's still a theoretical particle?
That I don't know.
Anyway.
And so, like, that is a fascinating thing. But, like, other times, Klosterman is interested in how the present will be remembered when it is the past. He asks questions like, which author will be remembered as our time's great author?
Oh, or boy.
Which band will symbolize rock and roll when rock and roll is dead? The rock and roll conversation is one of the most interesting parts of the book, as far as I'm concerned. Because on the one hand, you have options like Bob Dylan, who is nothing like rock and roll at all, but still representative of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Or... the Sex Pistols, who are, like, actually rock and roll, but refuse to acknowledge they represent anything that isn't punk. So, like, then he starts talking about what if you have, like, the Beatles. I mean, obviously, the Beatles are super famous, and, like, they just are, like, more mammoth as an identity than, like, yeah. their music even is.
A cultural force.
But he shoots that down because, like, that's not... something that people are going to keep talking about generations onward. He has like reasons for people won't be talking about it, and I can't quite recall at the moment. But He also gets into, like, what about the Rolling Stones? What about, like, ultimately, I think he settles on, but still acknowledges he could be completely wrong about Chuck Berry as, like, the embodiment of rock and roll, because, like, he's in and out of jail during his life. Like, he actually lives the rock and roll lifestyle. He actually made rock and roll music, which is something that most people within, like, the genre of rock can't be, like, really co-opted into anymore.
Yeah, the meaning has kind of disintegrated a little bit.
Right, which he addresses.
And, like, it keeps trying to come back, and then it keeps disintegrating again.
Like, as a thought experiment, it's fun, it's compelling. As I read, I kept on wondering what idea would come next, and, like, thinking over his conclusions, going, like, okay, like, do I agree with that? Like, what would I put forth as, like, rock and roll's band that would be the answer for, like, representing all of music? It's interesting because the entire book is so hypothetical as to the point where it could, like, you could just float away on it. You wouldn't really notice that you had just, like, lost all anchoring to reality.
Yeah.
But
he does see that being a problem.
He does manage to, like, actually keep you sort of engaged at least enough where you can, like, tie the thought experiment to yourself, like, tether in that way. And that's where his tone is super important. He is, as he is in his other works, very self-effacing and very humorous. As a for instance, I drew this quote. Klosterman notes that an NFL coach by the name of Jim Harbaugh, this coach once said, football is, quote, the last bastion of hope for toughness in America in men. Klosterman responds by writing, to anyone working or even anyone who cares about the media, Harbaugh's position seemed sexist and ultra-reactionary, so much so that Rush Limbaugh felt the need to support it on his radio show. Like, it's...
that fucking guy.
It's the kind of humor which makes But What If We're Wrong entertaining and readable, but it's also what makes the book possible. A lot of critics complained of Klosterman's book that he didn't take questions he raised seriously, calling it pop philosophy, that everything just leads to a shrug at the end of a long, fruitless expedition. These criticisms seem to me to miss the aim of the book altogether. It is impossible to know the future. This is, in part, Klosterman's point. To penalize uncertainty and humor when asking impossible questions is intellectually lazy. Especially when the book is vision sports, the nature of time, multiverses, democracy, and the way perception works, you have to have some allowance for a tone that, like, actually brings it together.
Yeah, that's a pretty wide swath.
Yeah, I mean, tell a couple jokes. You probably should, like, especially, oh my gosh, if... I think sometimes when critics sit down to read books by people like Malcolm Gladwell or Chuck Klosterman, where there's, like, a dose of self-excusing from, like, academic levels of scrutiny.
Yeah.
Like, just let that be.
Academia is largely unreadable.
Oh my God, yeah. My routine joke for my classmates in grad school is, if I turned in what they assigned us to read, I would be flagellated.
Yeah, like, it's a different standard. It has a different aim. That's not what it's supposed to do. Calm down.
Yeah, like, just let it be. I would ask, like, would you trust someone who wrote this book and claimed infallibility?
I don't know if I want to know the answer to that question. I've been meaning, like, Klosterman's one of those authors that, like, yeah, I know about you, you seem cool, but I've never actually read anything by him.
I have all but one of his books, if you would like to borrow.
What was his first, like, really famous one?
Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs.
That one, yes. Okay.
Which is that I don't have.
You contrarian, you.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I read it while borrowing it from a friend, so I haven't felt the need to, like, buy it just to, like, have it to prove that I read it.
Sure. Okay. So my third one was the first example that occurred to me. It is a movie that I've seen recently. And, like, while I was kind of thinking about, like, oh, okay, tone, what could I do for tone? Just on a lark, happened to watch this movie and was like, well, that, clearly. It's a movie that you might be familiar with. Because basically, what happened was, I was talking with my friend Chris about Nicolas Cage. And we ended up watching this, like, I think it's a series put out by GQ called, like, Iconic Roles or whatever, where, you know, they have an app talk about, like, oh yeah, these are famous roles that I played, and this is kind of, like, what I was doing and what I was thinking and everything. And, like, it sort of, hearing Nicolas Cage talk about his process is fascinating.
Oh, isn't it?
Because he's just sitting there, like, yeah, so I was, like, doing these eye movements because of, like, this thing about, like, German expressionism, and it's like, you are so informed and so thoughtful, and yet the choices you are making are still so strange. It's kind of awesome.
He bought, like, actual Egyptian totems to hide in his leather jacket on the movie Ghost Rider so that he could channel his shamanic spirits better.
My favorite story on that one was, like, during Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Oh,
yes. He was actually dry, but was, like, pretending to do cocaine the entire time and, like, freaking out. So, like, Werner Herzog was like, what's in the vial, Nicholas? And he was like, leave me alone! Get out of New Orleans! But this is an older film than that. This is pre-Oscar Nicolas Cage. It is also the most Nicolas Cage movie I've ever seen, in that his movie, or his performance, just anchors this entire movie. Like, it is a make-or-break prospect, and I'm really not sure which it is. And so I'm going to stop cock-teasing here. I am talking about Vampire's Kiss. Yes,
the one where he fucks the alphabet.
Yep. And eats the cockroach, and there's just so much going on here. So,
it's vampire with a Y, right?
I don't think it is. I think it's just vampire. I don't know if it's Vampire's Kiss or The Vampire's Kiss. I think it's just Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah, it's vampires.
So, one criticism of films that kind of comes up a lot if you read a lot of film criticism, which I do, is this movie is really sort of confused about its tone. We were talking about Vice earlier, actually, and, like, that was a criticism I read about that movie, where it's like, it doesn't seem to know how it feels about this, like, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that is very confused about its tone. So, plot summary for this 30-year-old movie, so, you know, spoilers, sorry. A cynical New Yorker experiences a psychosexual mental breakdown that is either ignored or tacitly encouraged by his environment to the point that he commits rape and murder before being murdered himself.
That's troubling.
I think it's a comedy. I don't know how it could not be, at least somewhat. Like, because first of all, you have Cage's performance, which is just so ridiculously over the top. Like,
he said that what he was trying to do with that performance was show, like, the true unraveling of the human mind.
And goddamn if he didn't. But, like, I can't imagine a director or anyone being like, yeah, no, that's totally serious. Let's do that with a straight face. And this is sort of reinforced by, like, certain other aspects of the film, editing in particular. There's one scene that I'm thinking of where, like, the woman that he has been terrorizing and her brother are, like, you know, looking for him. This is, like, toward the end of the film, so he's, like, you know, breakdown time. And they're like, let's say something if you see him. And then, like, right after that, it immediately cuts to, like, Nicolas Cage with plastic vampire fangs, like, stumbling down the street, mumbling to himself. Like, it's very dry, but it's definitely funny. Like, a lot of the dialogue is just kind of like, that's a joke, right? I'm pretty sure that's a joke, I think. The like Nicolas Cage meme where, like, he's got the hair slicked back and his eyes are, like, popping out of his face, like, that comes from this movie.
The like, oh yeah face.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, like, watching this thing, you really don't know how to feel. And the more I think about it, the more I think that might actually kind of be the point. Because this is not a particularly sympathetic character. Like, even before he goes full tilt, he's kind of an asshole. And then, like, he just keeps being, like, more of an asshole until it gets to the point where you realize that he is not really in control of what's happening to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this whole thing where, like, he takes Jennifer Beals home from a club and then, like, essentially fantasizes seeing her as a vampire for, like, the rest of the movie, and, like, that's the form that his delusion takes, and you don't necessarily realize it's a delusion at first. You're like, this is a straight-up horror movie. Like, he's being haunted by this vampire chick, and then, like, slowly you kind of come to the realization, no, she's not actually there, and then, like, he runs into the real woman at a club again, and she's like, oh, yeah, your name's Peter, right? We met that one time, and he's like, she's a vampire! And, like, gets kicked out of the club. And so, like, in watching it, like, it kind of starts that way, where it's, like, it tricks you into thinking it's one thing, and then slowly, as Nicolas Cage unravels, you... Nicolas Cage instead of the character's name, because, like, he's just that, you know? As he unravels, like, you kind of come to the realization that, like, okay, this is something that is happening to him. And this whole, like, support system around him is being permissive of this. Like, his psychologist kind of doesn't really call him out on any of these things. He has a psychologist, first of all, so that's kind of a tip off there. I mean, it was the 80s in New York, so I guess maybe not, but... still. But, like, there's a scene where he's, like, terrorizing his secretary by, like, literally, like, jumping over desks in the office and, like, chasing her into the bathroom to the point where, like, she feels, like, incredibly threatened and is like, I have a gun, you know, like, legitimately frightened. And then, like, a few minutes later, there's a scene where he's in the boardroom and all the devs are kind of like, hey, look at Attila the Hun over here, like, chiding him about it. And... that, I think, is kind of more the point of the movie, where it's, like, this kind of culture in which this person exists allows this to happen and fosters this and perpetuates this. And I think that tonal confusion contributes to that, because, like, every time you laugh in this movie, and you have to laugh because it's just so ridiculous, you feel uncomfortable, because it's like, what? Yeah. What's happening now? Yeah, I don't like this. Like, as if by laughing you become complicit in that allowance, I suppose, in, like, letting this character kind of become this monster, both literally and figuratively, who's, like, flipped over his leather couch and now treating it like a coffin lid and that he sleeps. It's so fucking dumb. But at the same time, you know, he's begging with strangers on the street, I'm a vampire, please stop me, kill me, and they're just like, whoa, fuck, dude, no. which is a natural human reaction. It's like what you do, but like this is someone who's in crisis, clearly, and we laugh. And that makes me like the movie a lot more than its critical reputation would, you know, suggest it's worth. Yeah. Actually, I was kind of blown away by it the more I thought about it. But it is definitely not for all tastes.
Yeah, that is one of the movies that like escaped my wrath. I don't even know. Like I loved watching as many of the Nicholas as I got to. I was just like in the middle of. Let me back up. I started a blog called feelingkg.tumblr.com where I was gonna watch and review every Nicolas Cage movie. Now here's the thing, I was trying to do one a week, and I was also writing like 5-page reviews of every movie.
And there's a lot of them.
There were, at the time of that project, 78 Nicolas Cage movies. We're now in the neighborhood of 85.
Okay.
So I got through a bunch, including some really bad ones. Quite possibly the worst one.
Ooh.
Deadfall.
Never did see that one.
Deadfall was written and directed by Nicolas Cage's little brother.
Ooh boy.
Nicolas Cage was allowed to write and design the costume of his own character.
I can only fucking imagine.
At one point, he beats it to death. A man in a strip club while screaming, "How's that for Sam fucking Peckinpah?"
Head meat ass.
That is literally the least weird thing he does in that movie.
Now I kind of want to watch that.
It's such a bad movie. Like, when Nick Cage is not on screen, it is the worst movie you've ever seen. And when he is on screen, it is the funniest movie you have ever seen. He tries to kill a man by shoving his head into a deep fryer while screaming, "Who's a hothead now?" Not the weirdest thing that he does in this movie.
It's beautiful.
Okay, you know, I could talk about Nicolas Cage literally all day, and I have before, so I won't. Instead, I'm gonna bring us home with the last entry of the season. Let's talk about Tone. Let's talk about Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
Yes. See, I was worried you might pick Atlanta. That's my number three.
We have touched on it, but not discussed it as a whole.
So, oh my god, Atlanta. If you don't know the information I'm about to provide to you about Atlanta, you are doing it wrong!
Yeah, stop listening to us and go watch it and then come back. Do come back, though.
It started in 2016... It is running until, as of now, the third season is due to come out this year, 2019. Very exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Is that
a spring one?
What?
Is that a spring series, I feel like?
I couldn't tell you. I only started watching the show recently enough that I haven't had... This will be the first season that comes out while I'm watching. Okay.
TV seasons are weird now. It used to be predictable, and now it's like, I could start whenever.
Right. So, 2016 to present, it is by Donald Glover. When I say by, I mean written by, directed by, created by, and starring Donald Glover. Also,
talented motherfucker.
Yeah, that guy, he knows what he's doing. Also starring Brian Tyree Henry as Paperboy, Lakeith Stanfield as Darius, and Zazie Beetz as Vanessa. It is a surreal comedy about life in Atlanta's hip-hop scene. Kind of. Like, that is technically a correct description. That is not an accurate description of the show.
Yeah, doesn't really capture it.
No. Here's what might capture it. It was renewed 2 weeks into its first season. That's how good it was. FX, go ahead.
Oh, as you said, and the second season was even better?
Yeah, the second season has a 99% on Metacritic. After that first season got a measly 97. It is really hard to explain for precisely the reason that I want to talk about it. It's tone.
Yeah. Tone is very much what it's about.
It's tone. It's difficult to track, but it's vital to the show. It is in large part because the show's humor is so surreal. I saw, like, the first episode. I think it was 10 minutes in, and I was like, this is the most surreal television program I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, yeah. Like, even... it's on par with Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
More accessible.
More accessible. I've never seen the Twin Peaks, so... That, for me, that Atlanta really is, like, the most surreal program I think I've ever seen. It's genuinely difficult to recount an episode or even a single moment from this show, like, as a means of illustrating it to somebody or telling somebody who hasn't seen it, because its tone is so key to what is happening that you're not going to be able to convey 100% of what is going on in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're going to come up wanting, period. And it's frustrating because it's such a good show. It makes me want to talk about it to people all the time. Here's a scene from the first episode. I'll try to illustrate both of my points. Main character, played by Donald Glover, is named Earn. Earn is talking to an old acquaintance who works at a radio station. The old acquaintance tells him a story that ends with his using the N-word. Right? Now, later, Earn is with his cousin, Paperboy, and they encounter that same guy from the radio station. Earn's like, hey man, why don't you tell me that story from earlier? And he does tell that same story, but conspicuously this time it is missing the N-word. All of a sudden, Donald Glover is surrounded by, like, more than one black person, and it is not okay to use that word.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, like, laugh-out-loud funny. But, like, watching the show... I laughed out loud. That's, like, hilarious, because it's so real, and it's so, like, it's so surreal. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
What else? What else do we have? Obviously, race is a key component here of the show. Practically every episode offers a perspective on race, or the state of black life today.
It seems like that's kind of part of what the surreality of it is about, is it's like, this is a surreal experience, is like being this conscious of race in America. Like, that colors your world in a way that if you don't have that is weird.
Right.
And it's communicating that.
I think it also, as some of the examples I have here later in my notes are going to show, like, it also shows that the experience of systematic and personal racism are both surreal. Like, it literally doesn't make sense at all the way that it gets carried out, and yet you have to stand there and be like, this thing that doesn't make sense is totally normal.
It's
because it is normal.
Still somehow what's happening.
Yeah, it's like such a brilliant take on portraying it.
Yeah.
What do I have? I hate when I have to turn the page in the notes. That's why Alex goes with the digital. You can just scroll.
It kind of helps. Actually, taking the notes is somewhat more frustrating.
I imagine.
I didn't mean to highlight that. Crap. Why is the keyboard coming up? Stop rotating! Etc.
So this series presents moments of racism as darkly surreal moments, which simultaneously horrify the viewer and tax the logical part of their brain. It's funny in the way that the show presents it, but it's still troubling. As in the episode when Earn tries to spend $100 bill, he goes, like, with his girlfriend. Sorry, I hesitate because, like, there's episodes where they argue about whether or not that's actually their relationship.
Their relationship is dynamic.
Yes. So, like, they're out, and he's trying to spend the money, and everywhere he tries to spend it, people turn him away. They just say that it's a counterfeit.
Mm.
The most surreal is a moment where he's at a counter, and he is trying to spend the $100 bill, and the person at the counter won't let him, and they tell him it's like a policy. So he steps to the side, and the person behind him in line, a white guy, steps up and immediately pays with a $100 bill, which he is given no guff for. As soon as Earn, like, tries to go, like, hey, man, that's screwed up, the man just pulls back his jacket to show that he has a pistol attached to him. At which point, Earn just goes, like, okay, have a good night, and walks away. An incredibly surreal experience, and it's just played for, like, this very bizarre comedy. Mm. It's really funny.
What can you do but laugh?
Atlanta's beautiful commentary is to show how absurd racism is while still carrying the weight of reality, where racism isn't funny. Atlanta's tone also shifts radically depending on its aim. Like, no episode in the show
from
feels...
From moment to moment, sometimes.
Right. No episode in the show feels quite like Teddy Perkins.
Oh, man, that one.
Like, Teddy Perkins is a straight-up horror offshoot of this show, concerned with the role of parents, artistic creation, and identity. But then, of course, there's also not an episode at all like the Fastnacht celebration. The one where Vanessa...
Where they go to the rich people's party?
That one is really crazy, but no, Vanessa is half German, and so like they go to the German festival.
How did I forget about that one?
Yeah, like the tone of that episode is excruciating.
Oh my god, yeah. Maybe that's why I blocked it out.
Yeah, like it's genuinely hard to watch. And it's interesting because like this bizarre festival manages to both provide Dakes as well as like a different style of the surreal comedy that Atlanta operates on.
Mm-hmm.
So I say Atlanta's tone is as vital to it as Donald Glover's vision is, and it is the heart of what makes Atlanta so uniquely affecting.
Agreed.
Fucking Atlanta.
Actually, that kind of like gives... I've been trying to think, like, okay, what's a good sort of working definition for tone? Because that's how I started this.
Mm-hmm.
And in thinking about it, it's like, okay, that... There was something you said toward the beginning of that segment, and I cannot remember exactly what it was, but it led to this sort of, like, okay, if I had to describe tone, it is the way in which the different elements of a work together to convey the experience. Like,
mm-hmm.
The tone is the amount of control that the artist has over that experience. And, like, different people are going to react to different things in different ways, so, like, some of that is going to be on the audience. Like, there's that give and take thing, but, like, the artist part of that, the cultivation of the experience is the tone of the thing.
Right.
So.
I always think of tone... at least in part, as what the artist wants the audience to feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously it's not the same as how the artist feels about the work, but...
Although that does get easily confused a lot.
Right. I mean, one would assume that the artist would want the audience to feel the same way about the work that the artist does, but...
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
There's that whole, like, discourse where it's like, sorry, I don't know how to write a villain who doesn't do villainous things. Anyway.
Well, that leads us to weekly recommendations, of which, this time, there are substantially more than normal, I think.
I've got a few. I don't know if I have more than normal.
I have way more than normal.
You seem bursting, so go for it.
Okay. In no particular order, I would like to recommend the movie Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Oh, that was good.
It is on Netflix. It is six different Western stories all brought together under the umbrella of one Coen Brothers movie. And
the fucking last segment.
Oh.
With, like... what I, you know, personally at least interpreted to be as, like, Joel and stand-ins of themselves dragging people to the underworld.
Yeah, so that's fantastic. I recommend that. The TV show Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I have been meaning to watch that.
Mike Schur is the funniest person on television. He created... Well, I mean, he was on The Office. He created Parks and Rec. He created Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He created The Good Place. And
the third season of which I also need to watch.
Oh, my gosh. I recommend all Mike Schur things, but Brooklyn Nine-Nine is so underrated. It does not get enough love. And the sixth season is now being released because it went a year being canceled, and then NBC was like, fine, so much hate mail, we'll bring it back.
Wasn't it on a different network originally? Yeah, and they were like, oh, yeah, we can, we'll take that.
Yeah, I think it started on NBC and then went to FX and then went back to NBC.
Ah.
I could be wrong. But it is, I think, probably, like, the most consistently funny show on television right now. So check that out. The television show Killing Eve, fantastic. It was a BBC America show brought to Hulu. Sandra Oh is a police profiler and...
Sold already.
Jody something is the, like... assassin she's tracking, and they're just so fascinating to watch. It's so whimsical. It's like not a realistic show at all. It's so much fun. Also the show Counterpoint, starring J.K. Simmons. I didn't know he had a show until recently.
I didn't either.
So he plays two people, himself and then himself from an alternate dimension. Counterpoint is where, like, in the 80s right? In the 80s, our universe bifurcated, but it didn't separate. And then, like, over time, it slowly separated. So, over more time, our alternate universe selves become less like ourselves.
Okay.
So, he meets... Like, he's, like, a put-upon, sad, like, sack of a husband who, like, just everything has gone wrong for his entire
February-ish,
life. And then... His alternate version self is like, I take what I want and everyone else can fucking deal with it. And it's so great to watch the two of them, like, not know what to do with each other. And it's also super dramatic and, like, mindfucky. So great. Watch that.
Oh, I do like a mindfuck.
I am almost through this list. The game Quiplash. It's a great party game. It's like $10. Everybody plays it on their phones. It's basically just, they put up, like, a prompt, like a fill-in-the-blank joke, and then everybody makes a joke on their phone, and then they all vote on who you think the funniest one is. It gets points. It's very entertaining. If you like that, then check out their other games. They have a fantastic one where everybody except for one person gets the same prompt, so you have to figure out who the liar is.
Yeah, that's fun.
Like, by making faces according to a different prompt, or, like, by... like, pointing fingers at someone according to a certain prompt. And, like, it's very easy to get outed as the wrong person. I forget what that one's called, but it's part of a Jackbox package. Check that out. Oh, I'm so close to being done. AP Bio. AP Bio is a show with both Patton Oswalt and Glenn Howerton, so you know it's good. It's just, like, literally the premise is there's a Harvard professor who got kicked out of Harvard who has to teach AP Bio, and he refuses to teach. It's more or less his character from It's Always Sunny.
Mm.
Check that one out. And finally, you gotta see the new Spider-Man movie.
I would like to.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Like, just the animation style alone makes me want to see it.
This is my way of selling it. I don't care for superheroes.
Yeah.
I multiple times teared up during Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It is so good, and Nicolas Cage is one of the Spider-Men. John Mulaney is another of the Spider-Men. And still a third Spider-Man is an 8-year-old Asian girl with a robot shaped like a spider.
Nice.
It is so good. That's my recommendations. Thank you for dealing with the 2 pages.
I've been saving that up.
I had a lot of great stuff experienced over this break.
Nice. I got a couple. Not quite that many, but let's see. I don't know if I've mentioned it before, because I don't remember, like, what the actual timeline for this show is, but I've been watching the original Star Trek series for the first time, because I kind of grew up picking up with the movies, but, like, never actually, and, like, Next Generation and Voyager and DS9 and all that but like never actually watched the whole original series until now. And I'm almost all the way through it, and it's goddamn delightful. Like, once you get used to the fact that television was paced very differently in the 60s, because, like, that does take a bit of adjustment, the fight scenes alone just make it worth it. Like, there's crazy body checking and tumbling all over the place. The colors are just, like, eye-bleedingly fantastic. All the aliens look like humans in weird clothes, except for the ones that, like, really don't. There's one episode in particular that, like, I watched the other night, and, like, it's, what day is it, January 20th, 2019 right now? And so the episode, Let This Be Your Last Battlefield, feels particularly timely, and I'll just kind of leave it at that. So there's that. As far as other things, I finished the video game that I was playing, which was the replay of the Dragon Age trilogy. And so then I was looking for, like, a new video game, and I tried a couple things, and I kind of wasn't feeling it. And then my friend Matt let me borrow, actually, the Spider-Man game. So we both have Spider-Man-based recommendations, because, like, it turns out that's exactly what I wanted. It's like, I'm just gonna, like, fuck around and swing around New York City and, like, beat up some bad guys, and it's great, and I love it. And, like, the controls are a little overwhelming, but if you just kind of hit buttons, you'll eventually get there, and you get the hang of it. It's pretty good. I'm gonna recommend a movie that I just watched that came out in 2012 called Gangs of West. It's kind of been called the Indian Godfather. It's longer than fuck. It was divided and conceived of as a single film, but divided into two parts because even Indian theaters were like, nah, we're not going to show our 5-hour and 20-minute movie, bro. So it's like two 2-hour and 40-minute movies instead. But it's about, like, mafia rivalries and vengeance in the city of Dhanbad over the course of, like, 60 years. Wow. And it's violent but stylish and complex. And at the top of the show I was talking, like, I don't even remember what led into it, but there was the joke because, like, there's a character in it whose name is Definite, and, like, that's his name. And there's a scene where, like, his half-brother, I think, relationships get complicated, is like, what's Definite's real name? What's Definite? What's Definite, though? It's like, he also doesn't speak English. Like, they're speaking in Hindi, so it's like, but the name is English, so it's like, well, what is Definite? Like, you know, like, Perpendicular's real name is Babu. No, his name is Definite. Well, what does Definite mean? Well, there's deaf, where, like, you can't hear, and a net. It's like, no, that's not it. Like, it's a fucking great scene. So, yeah, would recommend that. It's, you know, a bit to sit through, but worth it. What else has been really good lately? Actually, I'm going to recommend an app. Not that it needs recommending, like, it's pretty famous, but I started using Duolingo, and it's actually surprisingly effective. Like, I'm using it to brush up on Danish, which I took in college, which was, like, 4 years ago. And it's like, oh yeah, I should try and kind of remember that. And, like, it's really coming back. And I like the way that it's presented. It bugs you every day to use it. There's a surprising variety of languages on there. So that's kind of cool. Would recommend that.
Been thinking about brushing up on my Spanish. Mm-hmm. Taking a class entirely situated around translation really makes you feel like those languages you've lost have become phantom limbs.
Yeah, I know. That, and it's like, part of me was like, well, I actually almost put Hindi in there because it's like, well, I want to learn that, but I feel like I should, like, flex that muscle with something I'm a little more comfortable with first and then go down a new rabbit hole. But yeah, I love translation.
Before we get into our very last part of this show, which we'll be talking about new format
next season on,
I wanted to mention you mentioned, like, the very timely episode of Star Trek that is, oh, you know, 50 some years old.
Yeah.
I am taking a poetry course right now, and in our segment on the Harlem Renaissance, found this incredible poem called Southern Cop. I believe it is by Langston Hughes. If not, it is by Sterling Brown. And essentially, it's like, it begins by going, oh, that poor white cop. He shot that black guy, that poor white cop. And it just goes in, like, variations, like, oh, man, we have to understand that cop. We need to forgive that cop. We need to condone that cop. And, like, the question of what is it like to be on the other end of the equation is never raised, which is, like, fact. And it's written in, like, 1932. And it's like, yeah, we're still living 1932. Don't worry about it.
Mm.
It's not like this was an issue back then and now. Yep. That's weird.
But no, by all means, get rid of history degrees and universities and stuff. That's fine.
It would be a bummer if we had to repeat it forever. So let's get into it. Next season.
Yeah, we had talked about the idea of, like, posing a philosophical question and using art to answer it. I don't really have a solid grasp on what that means exactly, even though I don't know.
Me either, but I think
that's sort of the fun of it.
Yes, that is some of the fun of it. Well, I mean, okay, so part of what I was imagining was, like, we would pose the question, and then it would be like, pick three pieces of art that, like, prove different points that you're trying to prove.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it would essentially be, like, half essay and half
recommendation / fanning out.
But I would
info dump.
I would actually really like to see, as opposed to, like, one of us talking and then, like taking turns talking, have it be a little bit more...
A little more interplay.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's something that we didn't have...
Agreed.
...as much of as I think either of us would have wanted this season.
Okay.
What,
I guess, the where I'm hitting, like, a thing is, like, what kind of questions would be suited to that?
I feel like questions about, like, the role of art.
Mm.
Like, should something do something, should, like, accomplish a certain goal?
Or the capability of it.
Yeah,
like, we talked about, we've been talking kind of today about translation, because that's come up a lot, so that
mm-hmm.
could be kind of something to explore as well. Okay.
I'm sure as we have done, like, an episode, it will become a little bit more clear to us how to pose questions and how to pose answers.
Yeah. But what questions will we come up with? Cliffhanger.
We did it! Tune in next season to find out how we do it.
Yeah.
When we do it.
Do we know what we're doing? There's only one way to find out. See you next time.